From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. We'll start this hour with a shocking new report about the opioid epidemic. It says 500,000 people could die because of it over the next decade in this country. It comes from our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Meanwhile, President Trump's commission on the opioid crisis blew past its first deadline this week when a preliminary report was scheduled to be released but wasn't. Lev Fasher is a reporter with STAT and joins us from Washington. Hi, Lev.
Hi, Jeremy.
And to start, tell us a bit more about this report from STAT that the opioid epidemic could kill 500,000 people over the next 10 years.
Yeah, this is coming from a reporter for us down in Atlanta, Max Blau, who is reporting that overdoses kill more Americans under age 50 than any other cause of death. And the big takeaway is that a lot of university experts think essentially that this crisis is going to get worse before it gets better. There are some high-end and low-end estimates, but folks are essentially saying that this is a crisis decades in the making, and it's going to take more than just a few years to wind it down.
And there are a lot of people trying to figure out solutions for this, including this commission working for President Trump, which you wrote about this week. What were they supposed to do?
So President Trump in March convened this five-member bipartisan commission meant to address the opioid crisis. And when he convened the commission via executive order, he gave it 90 days to submit a preliminary report on federal strategies to address the crisis. The 90th day was yesterday, Tuesday, and no report was filed. But that's not very surprising, given that they only met for the first time about 2 weeks ago. So people who have been involved in that process are actually very happy with Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey, who is chairing the panel, think that he really has his head and heart in the right place. But it's again, not surprising that given the timetable with which they started their work, they did miss that preliminary deadline, and they're supposed to submit a final report by October.
Are they explaining why they only met for the first time 2 weeks ago when this is such an important topic?
You know, the president didn't announce the commission members on the date he announced the existence of the commission that would be chaired by Governor Christie. So, no, there's no official explanation. Again, I think people are happy with the direction of that commission, if not the pace. Then again, there are also people who are very skeptical that the commission can actually tell them anything new. People see this more as a medical crisis, as a funding and a resource crisis, not necessarily as a crisis that stems from lack of information.
Well, that brings us to the healthcare bill that has been moving through the Senate, although now it's delayed. A vote on it is delayed until after the July 4th recess. But there's been a backlash against the bill in part because of proposed Medicaid cuts that would impact addiction treatment.
Right. And there are some states where Medicaid reimbursement levels for all drug addiction costs and drug treatment costs exceed 50%, which is to say that if you roll back Medicaid eligibility and just availability of services funded by Medicaid, it's pretty tough to argue that there isn't going to be an adverse impact down the line for people who are struggling to get and pay for addiction treatment. And that's something that this commission is struggling with. Governor Roy Cooper of North Carolina said at one point during its first meeting that it would be naive, essentially, to ignore what's happening in Congress in the broader context of the debate surrounding the opioid crisis. And within that bill, there's a $2 billion dedicated fund pushed hard by two senators from West Virginia and Ohio, Shelley Moore Capito and Rob Portman. Advocates for treatment, advocates for recovery, really say that doesn't come anywhere near the amount that would be needed to overcome the cuts in future Medicaid spending. And even if it did, even if it was a much larger number in the realm of $100 or $200 billion, there simply wouldn't be as good an infrastructure to spend it as exists now via Medicaid and community clinics and the way folks get reimbursed for treatment.
Who else is working on the issue of opioids in this country? Are there other commissions out there that are meeting their deadlines?
The White House Commission is clearly supposed to be a running point on this crisis. There are a couple congressional actions that happened during the previous Congress that are just getting moving now. There was about $500 million in appropriations authorized via the 21st Century Cures Act, which is one of the last pieces of legislation the previous Congress passed that just got awarded, I believe, in April. So there's money that's been appropriated. There are efforts underway that are just getting rolling. When you do anything on this scale, it's not instant, and the spending takes a while to filter down to states and to communities. There are other efforts. This is something that a lot of governors and that legislators from around the country care about. Yesterday, I went to a press conference with the bipartisan Heroin Task Force, which is a group of several dozen members of the House of Representatives who are pushing a package of legislation to address the opioid crisis. There's some money in it. It's not really on the same scale. We're talking in the hundreds of millions and not billions. But there are different efforts in terms of privacy laws, in terms of displaying addiction history and medical records, in terms of adding some CDC grants to fund prevention efforts. So there are some efforts, but no, the White House Commission is supposed to be the authority nationally on this crisis.
That's Lev Fasher, who's a reporter with our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Lev, thank you.
Thanks.
And out of Venezuela, where the political and economic crisis has taken a bizarre turn, last night a police helicopter hovered over the country's Supreme Court and Interior Ministry. You can see and video the chopper and hear the gunfire. Venezuela's embattled leftist president Nicolas Maduro called it a terrorist attack. His critics called it a ruse to justify his crackdown on anti-government protesters who filled the streets for months as the country's economy crumbles. Andrew Rosati of Bloomberg News joins us from Caracas by Skype. And Andrew, the government is saying this attack was carried out by Oscar Perez, an elite policeman?
Yes, the government alleges that this top policeman, a member of the investigative unit, hijacked a helicopter, flew low over central and downtown Caracas, where government ministries, the Supreme Court, and even the presidential palace lie. He then opened fire. They said he fired about 15 rounds and threw a number of grenades. The opposition, however, you know, as you said, is completely flabbergasted by the event and asking how this is possible. They point to this gentleman has a movie star pass. He was confirmed he was in a Venezuelan film called Suspended Death, The Cop Caper. His Instagram account where he made the announcement of this attack and so-called insurrection is kind of filled with what appears to be almost glamour shots of him scuba diving, horseback riding. So everyone's very confused. I talked to lots of locals on the street today. Some people were just say this is a government manufactured distraction, saying, you know, this is they're trying to take the pressure off the streets and trying to hide the myriad problems the country has, such as triple-digit inflation, you know, rampant crime and corruption.
Well, also an attempt to rewrite the Constitution. I mean, talk about the fact that this was at the Supreme Court. What's the significance there?
One of the major things that happened while this was going on yesterday, while the attacks from the skies, is there was a standoff between members of the Venezuelan opposition in the Congress building. They were trapped in a pushing and shoving match with members of the National Guard. On top of that, as all this was happening last night, the Supreme Court whisked a number of late-night rulings through, one of them removing the powers of one of the government's top critics and dissidents. So many are pointing the fingers at the government and saying, like, look, this is a blatant distraction of another power grab.
Yeah. Well, look, as many as 80 people have already died in the violence in Venezuela. Some people are saying that it's, you know, inches away from civil war. What's your take?
I think the situation on the street is very unpredictable. We've seen as many as over a million people take to the streets in these 3 months of protests. Those numbers have petered out a bit, but the death toll keeps rising. We've seen protesters square off with National Guardsmen all across the city, erecting burning barricades, throwing rocks. The police forces returned with tear gas over bullets. People have been killed on both sides. The fighting has actually entered an airbase in recent days. So if anything, this will only fuel the fire here. I don't think either sides are going to back down in lieu of yesterday's events. If anything, I think some protesters might, you know, be even angrier after what happened.
And do you get the sense that they think that Maduro himself may have staged this in order to have an excuse for further attacking the protesters?
One of the most troubling things that a lot of reporters and the opposition are pointing to is this attack came hours after the president said that if the country was plunged into chaos, that he and his supporters, would be willing to defend the so-called revolution with guns. And I think there is a sense of fear here, and there's also a sense of anger. And as I said earlier, these events of yesterday doesn't appear to slow down the demonstration of the streets. There is a nationwide, it's called a trancazo, where citizens and will leave businesses, their work, day jobs, and go to the streets. They want the opposition wants everyone to essentially grind the city to a halt today. That hasn't been called off, and to my knowledge, more protests are on the way. So we haven't seen tensions ebb. If anything, they're rising.
Andrew Rosati with Bloomberg News in Caracas, Venezuela. Andrew, thank you.
Thank you.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says he's still optimistic about the Senate's version of health care reform, even though he delayed a vote on the bill because he doesn't yet have enough support among Republicans. Here's McConnell yesterday at the White House, where Republican senators were meeting with President Trump about the bill.
Everybody around the table is interested in getting to yes, interested in getting an outcome, because we know the status quo is simply unacceptable, unsustainable, and no action is just not an option.
Joining us now are Here and Now political analyst Paris Denard, Republican strategist. Hi, Paris.
Hey, Jeremy. How are you?
Doing well. And Angela Rye, Democratic strategist. Hi, Angela.
Hi, Jeremy.
And Angela, let me start with you. Do you think that after what we just saw happen yesterday, that the GOP health care reform is dead?
I think that the GOP healthcare reform and strategic plan are challenged. I think they could very well be on life support, no pun intended, when you consider the number of times that the GOP has tried to repeal with no replacement or repeal and replace Obamacare. You've seen them struggle for more than 7 years now. And so what you would think that would do is get people to the meeting of the minds to say, you know what, we believe that health care is a fundamental right for citizens in this country. And it's not just a privilege for a few. This is all about access, and it's time for us to solve for that. And that's what they haven't done, and that's why they're struggling.
Although we remember what happened in the House of Representatives when they couldn't get the votes they needed. They delayed things and then they came back and passed it. Paris, what are your thoughts?
Listen, I think that Senator McConnell did the right thing by giving the senators more time to reflect and come together and work with both sides of the aisle to get something done. I think at the end of the day, Angela is right. I don't think it's dead, but I think it is on life support. And I think that it's on life support because this is such a serious issue that Republicans know we have to get it right. The president he ran on this issue. He campaigned on it. He essentially won on this issue, amongst other issues. And so it is a priority. The House passed the bill, and now it's on to the Senate. And the people that talk about this in declarative terms as if this is the final bill are wrong. This is not the final bill. The Senate is a deliberative body. They're going to come together after the 4th of July recess, and I believe they're going to bring something that the American people can be proud of, because what we know is the alternative is just not going to work. It hasn't worked, it's not working, and it's not sustainable for the future.
Jeremy, one thing I think that is important for us to clarify, though, because you did mention that the House passed a bill, I think it's important to remember that the Senate would not at all consider that version of the bill, and that's for a good reason. The Republicans in the House make up a very different demographic than the Republicans in the Senate. Republicans in the Senate really reflect the country. You have Republicans in the House who are in very gerrymandered seats where they are very Republican. It's a whole lot easier to just run on a kind of a fight against anything Obama agenda, whereas in the Senate, you have to work towards more consensus, at least ideally.
What about the fear, Paris, that if these senators go back to their states, they're going to get an earful from constituents and they're going to be less likely to support this bill?
Again, they may be less likely to support that bill as it stands in current form, but I don't believe that's going to be the bill that is going to be ultimately voted upon by the Senate, because I think they're going to go back and they're going to hear both sides of the story. Listen, they're not just people who are supportive of Obamacare. There are a lot of people out there. Vice President Pence recently had a listening session with him this week that are suffering because of Obamacare. So it cuts both ways. So they're going to hear the good and the bad and the ugly. And I think they're going to come back with with a new resolve to work in a collaborative effort to get something done for the American people.
But you know, they started wrong, Jeremy. I keep having to chime in here because how do you create a health care task force or a special committee to look at the bill and you don't include any women and no person of color on that body? Like, that is what's problematic. Susan Collins, I think, said it best where she said, this isn't a bill that we can just tinker with and get it to the right place because fundamentally there are so many issues. And I think that is the real problem there. When you have a moderate Republican saying that, and even Ted Cruz talking about issues like the cost of the premiums and not really addressing it there, I think that's when you have a real problem.
Well, I think a bigger problem is that the Democrats, when they passed Obamacare, they had a lot of minorities and a lot of women at the table, and they still got it wrong, tremendously wrong. And so I think right at this point, we're trying to get something that's a better bill for the American people.
Let's talk about President Trump. He had a meeting with senators yesterday. Here he is.
This will be great if we get it done. And if we don't get it done, it's just going to be something that we're not going to like. And that's OK. And I understand that very well.
Now, he has come under some criticism for how he dealt with Senator Dean Heller, a Trump-connected political action committee targeted electorally vulnerable Nevada Senator Dean Heller because he criticized the bill last week. Mitch McConnell said those ads were beyond stupid. And yesterday, Senator Susan Collins said she was appalled by those ads. And she said Trump doesn't know how to work with Congress.
This president is the first president in our history who has had neither political nor military experience. And thus, it has been a challenge to him to learn how to interact with Congress and how to push his agenda forward.
Paris, that's a moderate Republican, but that's a Republican senator saying that.
Yeah, and I, you know, respectfully disagree with Senator Collins. Look, the president is one who comes from the outside. The American people knew that. That's why they voted for him. They wanted somebody that was different. And with all due respect, again, to Senator Collins, maybe it's the Senate. Maybe it's Senator Collins herself who needs to learn how to deal with this president. He's not George W. Bush. He's not Ronald Reagan. He's not Barack Hussein Obama. He is Donald J. Trump, and it's a different style. And maybe she and the Senate and the members of Congress who don't agree with his style or the way he manages should learn to adapt to the new reality, which is Donald Trump as president.
Angela?
I disagree with that. I think there are some fundamental rules that just ensure that there is a good relationship with the president and the Senate and the House. And I think that there are some fundamental rules on how you just, you know, behave as a decent human being. And I fundamentally disagree with folks needing to adapt all the way to Donald Trump. I think there's a lot of adapting and evolving that Donald Trump himself has to do.
And I want to correct something real quick, Jeremy. Just because a Donald Trump-affiliated PAC or this organization did this does not mean that the president sanctioned it. As we know with super PACs, there is no coordination or collaboration between the two. So to say that this was the president, I think, is incorrect.
Do you think that he would have said yes to this if it had been his choice? I mean,
I think
it wouldn't surprise anybody to know that.
That would have been breaking the law, and the president wouldn't do that.
No, but Paris, my point is, I don't think it would surprise anyone to think that Donald Trump, if he wanted to get back at somebody for criticizing the bill that he's trying to push through, that he would try to go after them. He always says, you know, somebody hits me, I hit them back twice as hard.
Well, I think in this case, it wasn't hitting necessarily Donald Trump. It's hitting the American people. Look, we have a unique opportunity to do something that is going to correct a wrong, which was Obamacare, and get something that's better. And remember, it's not taking everything away that was in Obamacare. There are some things that are in there that are good, like pre-existing conditions. It's making the bill better. It's more constructive to say, I want to work with this president. I want to work with my friends on the other side of the aisle and my Republican colleagues to do something that is good and make it better, than to just say, I'm not for it. I'm against it. This president doesn't have any political experience. This president doesn't have any military experience. That's not helpful.
All right. Let me ask you, Angela, about what's going on with the Democrats, because it's just been about a week since those special election losses for the Democrats. Yeah. There were calls from Democrats for Nancy Pelosi to step down as the Democratic leader in the House. Mm-hmm. Do you think that she should? And who do you think would be a good replacement for her?
So that's going to be a challenging second part of the question, because I don't think she should, for the reasons that are being articulated. We know, just like when of course, when Paris was at the RNC and Michael Steele was chairman, one of the most effective campaigns they had was the Fire Pelosi campaign. That is called, it's a classic messaging boogeyman strategy, and that's when you find someone who is the most senior to target. If you ask most of these people why they want Nancy Pelosi gone, they can't tell you why because they don't know what she does. Within the party, I'll tell you that since the campaign, frankly, since the 2016 election, folks have been scrambling to figure out who to blame. And now, because there's been a ton of shakeup that has happened at the DNC and that leadership hasn't really had the opportunity to settle in, they still need someone to blame. And that looks like Nancy Pelosi.
But it's effective, isn't it? Isn't it effective?
Yeah, it's absolutely effective. That doesn't mean that it's the right thing to do. And so to the second part of your question, I would say if Nancy Pelosi does decide to step aside, I think that it'll be great to have some young person run. I think Hakeem Jeffries would be amazing. New York congressman who is in House leadership now. Someone else that has that same strength and gravitas that Nancy Pelosi does, but also has fundraising prowess. And that's why it's been so hard to replace her or even get her to leave. She's great at fundraising. And obviously, we need that to win the House back in 2018.
I have to ask you both about one thing very quickly, which is a Washington Post story that finds that at least five of President Trump's golf clubs, there was a fake Time magazine cover with him on the cover that said the headline was "The Apprentice is a television smash!" Exclamation point. When go find me a Time magazine cover that has an exclamation point in the headline. Paris, your thoughts about that?
The president has a very wonderful sense of humor.
Oh, come on. This guy loves to say fake news in all of his remarks. This is the one time we can't get you to say fake news, Paris.
It would be one thing if this was actually something that was worth talking about. But I don't.
It is.
I think it's
Jeremy
a joke.
Just asked
it's
you.
A joke.
I don't think there was a plaque underneath it that said this is a joke. But anyway,
all right,
we'll leave
thank
it there. Paris Denard, Republican strategist, and Angela Rye, Democratic strategist. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Is a trade war coming for the steel industry? That's the concern of some experts waiting for a big announcement from the Trump administration this week. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross is releasing the results of an investigation that could pave the way for tariffs on steel imports. One expert told CNN it may be the most important trade decision in decades. Maggie Lake hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. She joins us from New York. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, Jeremy.
And earlier this month, President Trump promised to help the U.S. steel industry and said we're going to stop the dumping. What are we expecting this week?
You know, this was a big theme in Donald Trump's campaign and part of his promise to bring jobs back and make America great again. And from everything that he has said and his Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross is saying, we are expecting some kind of tariffs. I think almost everyone's really bracing for that. It could come this week, maybe next. But the big question is, how big are they? And very importantly, what country or countries are they leveled at?
How much does this have to do with defense?
Defense is at the key here. This is very, very important. You know, people may not realize we already have tariffs in place, pretty steep ones on Chinese steel imports. What the Commerce Secretary is looking at is invoking a special clause called Section 232, very specific sounding, but that would basically categorize steel as vital to the defense industry and protected against imports. And the steel industry has been trying to get this done for years, Bush administration, Clinton administration, and they never did. Because a lot of studies show that only about 3% of steel actually goes to defense. The reason that this administration wants to do it, though, is because the WTO tends to steer clear of issues when they involve national defense. So if they were able to get this categorized, it could be that they get those tariffs on and it's something the WTO it doesn't really get involved with.
And the auto industry watching very closely as well, right?
Yeah, they are, because they're very concerned that if this goes through and tariffs are imposed, that we will see retaliatory measures and that will make steel prices go up for everyone. Of course, the car companies still use a lot of steel, although they are increasingly moving to aluminum. And they're worried. They're worried this is going to become the start of a trade war. And it's not just steel, Jeremy. When we were in the campaign and through the beginning of the election, this is for all of the businesses that like the sound of tax reform, that the markets have been rallying on the hopes of a business-friendly environment. Trade and a trade war is the one issue that comes up again and again with CEOs as something that they are very concerned about.
Well, what are the countries that would be targeted with tariffs on steel?
So the feeling is that they're kind of going after China, but China's actually not even in the top 10 when it comes to steel because of all of these tariffs that exist already. Instead, you're looking at countries, including some allies, Canada, Mexico, Brazil, the EU, South Korea. By the way, the South Korean president, the new president, is in town this week.
Right.
And the timing is really interesting on this, too, because Trump is going to head to the G20 meeting in Hamburg next week. So the idea that they would level these tariffs just as he's going to this meeting against countries that are traditionally allies, I mean, a lot of people are wondering about it, but the feeling is that they are going to do something.
And there are fears that that something would lead to, as you say, a potential trade war, and that our agricultural exports could be hit by something like that. So
yeah, and that's right. So it's not just car companies. We were talking about retaliatory measures.
Right.
Farmers very concerned about this. A quarter of our produce and food products are shipped abroad. They are exported. So they're very concerned that other countries may slap tariffs on our food. So this is a really hot topic in Washington, the business world.
That's Maggie Lake, who hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. Maggie, thanks.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And last night's massive cyber attack, nicknamed Petya, started in Ukraine, and as it moved around the world, it froze ATMs, knocked out radiation monitoring computers at Chernobyl, hit the U.S. drug company Merck. The attack was similar to the WannaCry attack in May, and it's setting Golan Ben-Oni's hair on fire. Actually, it's adding to the flames that have been there since Golan's company, the New Jersey-based conglomerate IDT Corporation, was hit by an even worse attack in April, right after hacking tools made by the NSA, the U.S. National Security Agency, were leaked online by a group called the Shadow Brokers. The IDT attack in April and the WannaCry attack in May both used a stolen NSA weapon named Eternal Blue, which spreads ransomware. But IDT was also hit by Double Pulsar, which goes right to the heart or what's called the kernel of a computer system. Golan says ransomware attacks in which victims are asked for a few $100 in Bitcoin to unlock their frozen data are a cover for the more serious attacks. As he puts it, this is war. Golan Ben-Oni, Global Chief Information Officer at IDT, joins us now. Golan, when you heard about last night's attacks, you thought what?
Oh, boy. That was my first response. Mm-hmm. You know, we were really worried that what we saw back in April would really start to take the world by storm. And at the time, I was kind of accused of being, you know, maybe a little negative, you know, maybe this only happened to you. Mm-hmm. And one of the early indicators that this was dangerous was that it wasn't really about ransomware. What we saw did something else, which was very troubling, which essentially was that it stole credentials.
Yeah.
You know, when credentials, which are usernames and passwords, are taken, you start to worry about what's going to happen next. And this was very different from WannaCry, which essentially was just a ransomware event.
Well, and talk about how you found this. You have something like a black box that was recording this information. So it sounds to me as if, let's say that these attackers are like bank robbers. They went through the bank or your company, and as you said, they stripped all your contractors' credentials. They got past every alarm in the bank, if you will. But then after they got out, they said, give us $100 and we'll leave, when they'd already robbed the bank.
That's correct. In fact, the theft of credentials is a far more serious thing, obviously. And I like your analogy. First, you made kind of two analogies. One was a black box. You know, the easiest way to describe it would really be like a flight recorder on an airplane that will measure everything from temperature to speed and altitude. And we had the same exact thing running on the machines. And the reason we do that is that, you know, we're quite clear. There's no silver bullet in security. And if something happens, you kind of need to replay the tape and watch what happened. And it was extremely crafty. You know, it also took a look to see what other machines that system connects to, and it attempted to move laterally. And you know, we were very fortunate to have caught this so quickly that, you know, it made no further impact there.
But adding to your concerns, it wasn't spotted by any leading cybersecurity products.
That's correct. And, you know, the trouble that we're having here is that these tools were designed not to be spotted. I mean, these were created by some of the top security individuals on the planet, you know, who happened to work for the U.S. government. So the reason that this was largely successful was because it was designed to go undetected.
Yeah. Well, and the other concern, if I've got this right, is it's not just that it attacked your company, but it sort of implanted itself in other companies as well? I mean, are you saying that it went from your company and wormed its way into other companies and is just lying in wait?
Well, okay, yes and no. This had worm-like capabilities, which means that, you know, we saw it attempt to move out. But when it failed to do so, it triggered the ransomware event, which basically was kind of like the match that burned the house down. Mm. So at that point, the system essentially took itself out of service. So it did not spread any further. We did take a very close look at the systems that came to us because, again, we recorded them. And what we realized is that those systems were also compromised.
You've been pursuing the IDT case with your team there at your company. And do I understand you've tracked it to a personal Android phone in Russia?
That's correct. So my team at IDT and now, you know, my new company, IOS Security or IO Security, took a look at the attack vectors. While I can't get into too much public detail about how we did so, we did find our attacker.
Well, is it an individual? I mean, what do you mean? I mean, you found a phone, but what's the next step?
Well, ordinarily, you know, when you provide this kind of detail to law enforcement, you know, it's really in their hands at that point. And it's enough basically for them to take the next step.
Okay. So you think that your attack might be tied to an Android phone out of Russia. Last night's attack, Petya, affected Russia. People were standing at ATM machines, couldn't use them.
Yes.
Who do you think this is globally?
Well, you know, here's the problem. Once the NSA tools get released, basically the first thing that's going to happen is a significant reverse engineering of that code to try and understand how it worked. And then for any interested party, they can begin to make use of that for anything they want.
Well, in fact, there's YouTube videos showing people how to use them.
That's correct. And the reality is that there are tools out there that has weaponized, you know, tools. And I can tell you that I know of 14-year-old kids that can do this.
Well, you were a 14-year-old kid who could have done this. We understand that when you were coming up, I mean, you always loved pulling apart things. And I'm reading in the New York Times, your family had to go find old typewriters so that you could pull them apart. And that you once inadvertently took down Belgium's entire phone system for 15 minutes.
Yeah, so that's true. I, at the time, was a teenager, you know, traveling between Israel, Germany, and the Netherlands. I was basically getting a lesson from a Dutch hacker about in-band signaling and how to use the blue box. And the, you know, European system used a different system than the American. It used what's called an R2 signaling system, which you basically play tones to a switch. It plays tones back. And what we didn't realize is that if you key in the wrong ones, you can actually cause the system to crash. Yeah. And the international switching infrastructure in Belgium actually went down for 15 minutes. And when we couldn't get back into it, we started making calls into the United States asking if they could contact Belgium, and no one was getting through.
Look, so you have had a sense of this for a long time. And now, as we said, your hair's on fire. You've been calling everybody, telling everybody, Microsoft, Google, Amazon. What about the patches? What about the fixes that Microsoft sends out? Now, we understand that last night it was revealed that the patches that had been sent out to sort of block this attack based on the last attack and the awareness of what was going on, either people didn't install them or didn't install them correctly in many cases. But won't that be, you know, refined? Won't eventually people just have patches to stop this?
So I have two responses to this. The first is that, you know, the attacks that we saw leveraged two NSA tools, Eternal Blue and Double Pulsar, that were addressed by Microsoft back in March. You know, if the average organization is taking 120 days to issue patches and, you know, these NSA tools get dropped and people start weaponizing them, there really isn't a lot of time to get that done. So that's one thing that we learned. But the other is that the industry has been telling everybody that all you have to do is patch. And what we've come to learn over the evening last night is that that's not always true. That it really only takes one unpatched system to get hit, and then from there it can move laterally in your organization and even affect systems that are fully patched.
Yeah.
So this is the problem now, that you can do everything everyone has told you to do and you can still be vulnerable.
Well, you had three firewalls, three antivirus solutions, and three intrusion detection systems, and you were hit in April. Look, you say that this is a life or death situation.
That's correct. I believe that. You know, I'd heard reports that people weren't getting surgeries in hospitals. You know, this is serious. I could tell you the risks to IoT security are extremely high. And in, you know, the medical device world, we have a new problem, which is that these systems can't even get patches. And, you know, this is a new area that really needs to be really focused on, which is the threat of IoT security, which is the next domain that's going to be a problem for us.
Internet of Things, in other words, your baby monitor.
Yeah, your heart pace monitor, or yeah, even your pacemaker.
Golan Benoni, Global Chief Information Officer at the IDT Corporation. They were cyber attacked back in April, first of the latest series of these attacks, and he's been trying to sound the alarm since then. Golan, thanks so much for talking to us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And by the way, he says the FBI says don't pay if you have a ransomware attack. Golan's advice, first of all, back up everything. But if you haven't, make sure you know how to get Bitcoin in case you decide you do have to pay ransom.
The 4th of July is next week, a time when many of us like to fire up the grill, including here and now resident chef Kathy Gunst, who joins us in the studio. Hi, Kathy.
Hello. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people fire up the grill for meat. You have some other ideas.
Yeah. I mean, sure. You have your burgers, you have your hot dogs, you have your chicken and your steak, but veggies tend to be on the side. And I thought it would be fun to take a look at vegetables being front and center for your holiday grilling enjoyment.
Boy, and you are not kidding. I mean, look at the skewer here. It is loaded. So you got the skewers first.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about that. Mm-hmm. So that is the most fun recipe because there's really no recipe. But of course, I've given you one. Mm-hmm. I took all kinds of vegetables, red peppers, yellow peppers, mushrooms, mm-hmm, zucchini, yellow squash, basil leaves, lemon.
Basil leaves
are on there, interspersed next to the cherry tomatoes. And you brush it with olive oil and you grill it until it gets these beautiful charred marks. And then what I like to do, particularly if I have a hot fire, you often do this in meat cooking, is you take it from the hot direct heat off of that to indirect heat. So the vegetables will soften and cook without getting black or burnt.
You mean on the edge of the grill?
On the side, yeah. Okay. So you heat one side, direct heat, mm-hmm, versus the indirect where the heat's not under it. It's often used for steak and big cuts of meat, but I did it with the veggie kebabs. And then you have a green sauce next to them, which is a chimichurri, which is an Argentinian sauce that's traditionally served
steak.
With steak.
Right.
Meat man, he knows his chimichurri.
Well, yeah, he also knows his Argentina.
Well, he knows that too. Yeah. And it's just all fresh herbs from the garden, parsley, cilantro, basil, little chili pepper and capers, some olive oil. You whirl it in a blender or a food processor and you can keep it for several days. It goes with any grilled veggie.
Okay, I have grilled with you. And you use wooden skewers.
I have.
And do you use the spritzer or the water spritzer? I mean, how do you keep them from burning?
No. So if you're going to use wooden skewers, which I don't like because they're so thin that it's hard to put hefty things on them, but you want to soak them in a sink full or a bowl full of water for a good 20 minutes and then dry them off, and they will not catch fire as easily. But so you can see, I like metal skewers. They're all kinds of ornamental skewers. They're fun, and it's just such a great presentation to give everybody their own skewer with a big bowl of the chimichurri.
I have a friend who once put foie gras on a grill. Bad idea.
Bad idea.
Very bad idea.
Yeah,
okay,
well,
forget about all the objections to foie gras. Just not a good idea.
You're going to get letters, mister.
Okay, what about this? What about this avocado?
Yeah, everything this morning, here? They said, and Kathy's going to do, excuse me, I'm talking with my mouth full. I can't help it. They said, Kathy's going to grill an avocado. I said, that is the strangest thing. And everyone said, no, it's fantastic.
Well, I'm surprised how many people around here have walked into the kitchen while I was cooking and they said, oh, grilled avocados.
Do
and
it all
I said,
the time.
You've heard of it? So I have not had them much. The idea here is you have a hot grill. Mm-hmm. You grill them for just a minute. So the bottom layer is still cold and creamy, but the top layer is charred and smoky little hot.
They full when you grill
them? You cut them
whole.
In half.
Cut them in
you
half.
Take the pit out. You crisscross pattern in them, little oil. grill them for a minute, turning them so they get nice grill marks. And then there's tamari or soy sauce in the middle. And then you have ginger, pickled ginger, mm-hmm. called gari that you see with sushi, and some wasabi, and lime wedges that have been coated in sesame seeds. Oh. So squeeze the lime and the sesame. Squeam the lime and the sesame. In your avocado.
Those seeds are wonderful.
Isn't that great? Yeah. Uh-huh. So it's a great way to have all these flavors and textures. Thus, this is the recipe for everyone who says, I don't have time to cook.
And it's still refreshing. Avocados, I think, are really refreshing. And you would think if you put it on the grill, it wouldn't be, but
no,
it is.
It's great. And it's a great alternative to sort of guacamole, which everybody does at the holidays. Mm. So that's one. Then the third dish you have is a grilled asparagus. Asparagus grill really well. But I also grilled a lemon. So it has lovely char marks. And I grilled cherry tomatoes. And then I sprinkled it, while it was still a tiny bit warm, with cubes of sheep's milk feta cheese.
Can I ask, though, how do you...
You can ask anything.
When I grill vegetables, many of them end up in the flame, like
yes.
in the fire. They fall through. So what would you do the asparagus
on? So you need very few pieces of equipment to grill vegetables, but you want what's called a grill basket or a grill plate that has small perforated holes in it. Mm. So the heat comes through, but the veggies don't go through the grill. That's the most frustrating thing.
Yeah.
So the asparagus, for instance, if I hadn't had them on that grill plate or grill plastic, they would have ended up in the bottom of the barbecue.
With
but
mine.
They did not.
You have put feta on here, which is the greatest thing, with grilled vegetables.
I'm with you. The creamy, the mild against the charred and the hot veggies. It's great contrast, great color. We're always thinking about colors and textures. So you have the green grilled asparagus, the red of the roasted cherry tomatoes, the yellow of the lemon, and then that creamy white feta.
And you can see all of the pictures of this and the recipes at hereandnow.org.
I was going to say, and we have lunch. Thank you, Kathy.
Anytime.
Kathy Gunn's Here Now, resident chef. And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.